Good morning.
We want to welcome you to Third Unitarian Church. My name is Reverend Colleen Behe, and I have been delighted to serve this congregation for the past 7 months. We gather here in covenant and commitment to enrich our spirit and motivate action. Whoever you are, wherever you are on your life's journey, you are welcome here. We are delighted to welcome back many old and new friends today. There are too many of you to name, and I don't want to miss anyone, but please know we are delighted to have each of you here. We have a few brief announcements. Next Sunday, April 29th, will be our Music Sunday. Musicians and vocalists of all ages will share their gifts with us. Remember, there is one more rehearsal for the choir right after service today, and please see our music director, Kyle Stevens, if you have any questions. Mark your calendars for Sunday, May 6th, when our annual live auction fundraiser will be held right after service. Lunch and childcare will be provided. You won't want to miss it. Catalogs with all the events and services will be available next Sunday and on the website. We ask you to please silence your cell phones during our service today. Thank you, and again, welcome. Our chalice this morning, the symbol of our living tradition. We give thanks for this time together and for each person gathered here. May we be inspired and challenged, nurtured and strengthened by the words and the music that we share today. We invite you to rise now in body or in spirit and let us join together in singing hymn number 128. invite you to remain standing as we join together in the words of our covenant, which are printed in your order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. You may be seated.
The most dangerous man in America. Those are the words of Henry Kissinger in 1971, when our speaker's father, Daniel Ellsberg, released the Pentagon Papers with the help of Robert, who helped him copy them. And he is our speaker today. We are pleased you're with us at Third Unitarian Church in Austin, area of Chicago. Also with us is, for every lecturer since he retired, is Reverend Donald H. Wheat. And if you didn't recognize him now, you can speak with him downstairs afterward. Accompanying Donald, Reverend Wheat, is his daughter, Sarah Wheat, from Austin, Texas. Andrew Wheat, his son, from Austin also, Texas. Mark Wheat, from San Diego, California. And Emerson, and one of his five grandsons. So before I introduce Mr. Ellsberg, I wish to just briefly describe, and it has to be brief, according to Don, the third reason for this third church lectureship. For about 26 years, through the latter half of the Vietnam era, appropriate actually today with our speaker, the Nixon years, the Ford years, the Carter years, the Reagan years, it's getting depressing, the George H.W. Bush years, and most of the Clinton years, Reverend Wheat led the church with vigor and commitment. With his energetic guidance, the church sponsored many, many activities and important speakers, and I just want to mention one that he started along with Roberta Wilson. Roberta, are you here?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Stand up, Roberta. She doesn't want to stand up. Oh, you're over here. You're usually up back. Great. I was looking around. Okay, Roberta Wilson and Don Wheat and started the college scholarship fund for the Austin High School graduates in the neighborhood. And it continues with her guidance. And it was helped by the late Eleanor Lukacheski, who's here in spirit also. So after Reverend Wheat retired in mid-1990s, Eleanor Lukacheski spearheaded this annual Wheat Lectureship. And I don't know if her son, the Reverend Lee Lukacheski, is here. Are you here or not? He was hoping to make it. And at any rate, Eleanor started it. And so we underwrite this Wheat Lectureship by your donations. And so in your order of service, there is an envelope. If you can help us out on this Wheat Lectureship, that'd be fantastic. So just, you know, mark the check if, as it indicated for the Wheat Lectureship, and put it in the envelope that we picked up during the collection. Robert Ellsberg's bio is present on the back of the order of service, but I wanted to add a few particulars. After he graduated from Harvard, first with his bachelor's degree and then later with his master's in theology, Mr. Ellsberg joined the Catholic worker community in New York City and eventually became the manager of its well-known newspaper of the same name. And he worked closely with the famous social activist and community activist, Catholic activist, Dorothy Day. Indeed, he is on the executive committee that is promoting the cause for Dorothy Day's canonization. As editor-in-chief of Orbis Publishing for many years, he's edited numerous books, several on Dorothy Day's life, and he's written several too, and two of those will be downstairs to be purchased, if you wish, and signed by him. One is called All Saints, and the second is Blessed Among Us. I like to point out that among the many great lives he describes in All Saints are several of Third Church's saints on the walls. For example, Harriet Tubman, Camus, and I think Thoreau are in his book and are on our walls. Even if you don't choose to buy any books, please join us downstairs after for the coffee and tea and snacks. And you can talk with Reverend Wee and our speaker. Parenthetically, Mr. Ellsberg, Reverend Wee, tells me that he wants you to know, had he been minister, when these murals were put up on the wall, he was not, they were already up, he would have lobbied to have a mural for Dorothy Day. So in the recent Oscar-nominated movie and the Golden Globe winner, The Post, we saw Robert Ellsberg portrayed as a teenager, aiding his father and copying the Pentagon Papers. Today we see the real Robert Ellsberg in full bloom. Please welcome Robert Ellsberg to the Thomas Paine pulpit of Third Unitarian Church, where he will speak on One Lamp Lights Another, the power of living witness.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful to Reverend Wheat and Colleen for opportunity to be with you. I'm very honored that I recognize in the audience a number of old friends who came from some distance to be here today and to cheer me on. So I or to expose me afterwards. So thank you very much for being here. And I must say, I do feel as if we are surrounded by what the author of the letter to Hebrews says, calls a mighty cloud of witnesses. As Michael mentioned, many of them included in my book, All Saints. I kind of appreciate the idea of the Unitarian Church to not have a formal process of canonization, evidently. You don't have to have been perfectly orthodox, whatever that means, or have lived a kind of stainless life, or certainly to have performed miracles, to acknowledge that there are people who have enlarged our capacity to understand what it means to be human in the best sense and in response to the challenges of history, and making use of our own imperfect human material in doing that. I acknowledge in particular Mohandas Gandhi, who has played an enormous role in my own life. You know that he was called Mahatma Gandhi, and Mahatma means great soul. And I think that that is a word I would like to appropriate for Mahatma Romero and Mahatma Dorothy Day, great souls. Great souls have always played a very important role in my life. But I also remember a critical formative experience that I had when I was about 10th grade. And I happened to find on the library shelf in my high school a little book called The Little Flowers of St. Francis. And I kind of heard of St. Francis, didn't know really much about him, but I pulled this book down and was immediately captivated by what a winsome and appealing and challenging person he was. I just love this guy. And I remember going to my teacher and saying, I've just been reading this amazing book about this guy, St. Francis. Like I didn't know he was a really famous person or something. I discovered this little known character. And I was describing some of the things, you know, whether he was preaching to the birds or stripping off of his fine clothes and working with the poor. And my teacher, and this I have to point out, this was an Episcopal high school, said, you don't actually believe all that stuff, do you? And I don't know exactly what he was responding to or thinking of, but I felt, I don't know if I had the nerve to say it out loud, but you know, my heart was saying, yes, I do believe this stuff. St. Francis had that effect on a lot of people in his own time. in his own community when he kind of declared himself by stripping off of his father's fine clothes and putting on a rough, you know, a habit and going and living among the poor. A lot of people thought he was a kook, but there were a lot of people from well-to-do, wealthy families, men and women, who found this extremely challenging and compelling. Now, as I said, I grew up in the Episcopal Church. I later became a Catholic. But growing up, you know, I had pretty much the idea that being a Christian was a matter of going to church and reciting the creed and, you know, being a good person. Nothing wrong with that. But here is St. Francis, who is suggesting that to be a Christian is to live the way Jesus did, is to actually imitate him. And he immediately picked up on this obvious fact when you read the Gospels through those eyes, but not so clear to the church of his time, that meant being close and intimate with the poor. Jesus had no home. He hung out with poor people, with sick people, the riffraff, the margins, the sinners. And here the church had come to be so comfortable with the rich and powerful. St. Francis kind of turned that all upside down. It was like pressing this kind of reset button on Christianity. To say that, well, let me back up a little bit. You know, Francis, a great turning point in his life when he was kind of searching for his vocation, and he was praying in a dilapidated chapel, and he heard a voice speak to him from crucifix in the chapel, saying, "Francis, repair my church, which has fallen into ruin," as you can see. So Francis initially takes this very literally, and thinks, you know, I'm supposed to rebuild this chapel here, which he started to do with his own bare hands. He actually stole garments, cloth from his father's warehouse. He was a wealthy cloth merchant, and was using the money to get, you know, to pay for this rebuilding program. And it was gradually, though, that he came to the insight that that was not what this voice from the cross was asking him to do, not to rebuild a chapel, not to build things, to repair the church which had fallen into ruins because of its losing touch with Jesus, losing touch with the poor man Jesus, this challenger of the status quo, this person who was so dangerous that the religious and political authorities of his time had to kill him in the most painful way they could come up with, but still didn't stop his message, lived on. And people began to respond to this, as I said, in his neighbors. But gradually, it kind of spread like a wildfire through Europe, and people began flocking to this new movement. Not just poor people, but rich people, princes, princesses, kind of took on the Franciscan way. Well, that challenge of St. Francis, you know, he can become domesticated over time. Now we might think he's the patron of birdbaths or something like that. A kind of a sweet character, you know, holy fool, and lose touch with the radical challenge he posed in his time, and if we take him seriously to any time, especially a time such as ours, when so much emphasis is on bigness and winning and being number one and being the greatest. And here's Francis, you know, saying that the church, that to be a Christian is to take your place among the least, and to see history, to see the world from below, from the perspective of those who suffer, from those who are hurting. That message has popped up in all different kinds of places over time. Sometimes a spark like that will kind of seem to go out, but it actually is carried by the wind, and it lands somewhere centuries later. It starts a little flame. St. Ignatius, in the 16th century, a Spanish soldier and courtier, was recovering from war injuries, and he asked for something to read. He was hoping for stories about knights and courtly romance and battle and that sort of thing. The only book that they had, to his regret, was The Golden Legend, the famous medieval Lives of the Saints. And he began reading these stories, and it began to have this his kind of heart beating in a way. What kind of Ignatius would later devise this language of consolation and desolation that helps you kind of discern your path or how to make decisions, how to choose your vocation. And for him, you know, consolation is that kind of affirmation from God that you're going in the right direction. And he felt that as he was reading these lives. And he asked himself, what would it be like if I lived like St. Francis? Well, he didn't become a Franciscan. He became the founder of the Society of Jesus, otherwise known as the Jesuits. And it's funny that it took a Jesuit pope, the first Jesuit pope, to take the name Francis and, in effect, claim for the Universal Church that perspective of St. Francis, going back, you know, to the Middle Ages. When Cardinal Bergoglio was elected pope and he chose the name Francis, people were wondering, what did he mean by that? I mean, like Francis Xavier, famous Jesuit, Francis de Sales, doctor of the church. And he clarified right away. He said, as I heard the votes were being tallied up and looked like it was going in this terrible direction, a cardinal from Brazil whispered to me, remember the poor. And immediately when he said that, I thought of the name of St. Francis, the poor man, the man who with his spirit of joy, his celebration of creation, his community with animals and all life, his concern for the weak and the poor and for peace. And I thought to myself, yes, that's what I want, a poor church for the poor. Now, that might have just stayed, you know, on the level of sweet gestures like paying for his hotel bill and carrying his own suitcase and not wearing red slippers or whatever. But it soon became very clear that for Pope Francis, the choice of this name was more than a name. It was a signaled an agenda, a program. Pope Francis's agenda he defined as countering the introversion, the spiritual narcissism, the spiritual worldliness of a church that thinks that it exists for its own sake instead of for the sake of the world. He said, we have to open up the doors. We have to go out to the margins, out to the peripheries, out to where people are hurting, where we can touch the wounds of Christ. His first trip outside of Rome was to the island of Lampedusa, which is a way station for lots of refugees in the Mediterranean, where thousands of people have died in those seas there. And he gave a most affecting and beautiful homily, which pretty much, very much, I think, set the course of his agenda, where he talked about God who confronts Cain and says, Cain, where is your brother Abel? And Cain says, my brother's keeper. And, you know, he is convicted by his own words. The blood of Abel cries out from the ground. God hears that cry, the cry of the blood that has been shed. And Pope Francis hears that cry also, the cry of the poor, the cry of the earth, the cry of those who are neglected, the throwaway people, the disposable people. And he decries the culture of indifference, as he calls it, the consumerism, the fast pace, the concern for success and bigness that makes it impossible for us even to recognize other people as our brothers and sisters. Well, I mentioned the impact on me of reading The Little Flowers of St. Francis. I didn't become a Franciscan. But I did join a community, as Michael mentioned, called the Catholic Worker in New York City, where I found a kind of a Franciscan spirit, a kind of Franciscan community. This is the community started during the Depression by Dorothy Day, who was a convert who had spent her early youth as a journalist and activist and ally of many radical social causes. She actually lived here in Chicago in her childhood and then later, at a later time. She was arrested here in Chicago once she was staying in a house, a boarding house run by the IWW, and was raided by the police. And she was accused of occupying a house of ill repute, a body house. She said, at the time, I was spared the indignity of realizing that I'd been accused of being a prostitute and how embarrassing that might have been to be seen on the street and all this. Although later on, she thought, well, what's so embarrassing about that? What's so embarrassing about being accounted, you know, a person of, held in contempt by the society. Anyway, that was before her conversion that occurred in the 20s. She became a Catholic, but then went through this lonely period of feeling a kind of estrangement from the cause of the poor and oppressed, because it seemed as if the church had, as it continuously does, seemed to be making its alliance with the rich and powerful. And she prayed for some sign of how she could put together her Catholic faith and her commitment to the poor and to social justice. And when she came home after making this prayer, she found this kind of unkempt Frenchman named Peter Morin, she said was a kind of St. Francis of his time, who had been looking for someone to help him put in motion this vision he had of a Catholic movement that would propagate and live out the radical implications or social teachings of the gospel. He said there was dynamite in the church, but church authorities tended to sit on that dynamite. He wanted to blow the dynamite of the church, he said. And his method was not to agitate for the government to take care of problems or for the church as a large institution, but for to call on Christians to live out immediately right now with the means that they had at hand, to care for their brothers and sisters who were poor or homeless, which they did, establishing a house of hospitality in New York City and others that spread around the country, publishing a newspaper, The Catholic Worker, which, as was mentioned, I served for a couple of years as managing editor. But not just practicing the works of mercy, not just caring for the poor through charitable acts, which many holy people have done through history, many religious orders, but combining that with a radical social critique of the society that gives rise to and cause for so much poverty and oppression. And she connected that also with a radical vision of nonviolence that was quite outside the mainstream for her time. Less so now, but embraced very much by Pope Francis and others. But in her time, it was just almost unthinkable that you could not be a pacifist and a Catholic. The Catholics believed in the just war doctrine. Catholics served proudly in every war on both sides. But it was really kind of her sense of this, of the radical implications of the gospel, the same spirit as St. Francis. Pope Francis has cited that himself in his latest document on holiness, which he released just a week ago, 2 weeks ago. He talks about, first of all, the Beatitudes. He said, wouldn't it be great if Jesus, you know, gave us a handbook on how to be holy, how to be a saint? Well, he said, it's right there in the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes. Blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the merciful. Pope Francis says this is an identity ticket for Christians. You could say it's a kind of job description. But we hear it, you know, we hear it sort of so often. It's like the instructions that they give you when you're on an airplane. You've heard it about, you know, 1,000 times, and you kind of tune out when they're saying, should we lose in the unlikely event that we lose altitude? You know, put your seats in an upright position, and you don't listen to that kind of stuff until suddenly they say, you know, we're in trouble. Then you wish maybe, how do you put on that mask again? So the Beatitudes, and then Jesus' words in Matthew 25, the incredible parable where he says, you know, I was hungry and you fed me, I was naked and you clothed me. Insofar as you did these things to the least of my brothers and sisters, you did them to me. But there's another side to that verse as well. Insofar as you did not do these things for my brothers and sisters, you did not do them for me. So we don't just add up, you know, all the little good deeds, you know, we did. Well, we did feed somebody one time. But all the countless opportunities that we have in our lives and in our daily experience to not recognize Christ in our neighbor, that is almost overwhelming when you think of, and you tally that up, the record in most of our lives, or in the lives of, or the experience of a culture, of a society. All the people who are hungry, who are naked, who are homeless, who were in prison, who were sick, and we left them there. That's also part of the calculus. So Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, you know, tried to set that, you know, the Beatitudes, Matthew 25, into action. And that's what attracted me to go stay there for some time. I wasn't there very long before I became aware of how much Catholic Worker actually referenced or appealed to the memory of St. Francis and other saints, in the sense that we are called to live the way Jesus did. That's what it's about. That's the job profile, job description for a Christian. And Dorothy Day herself spoke all the time about saints, as if they were people that she knew, not just, you know, perfect people in a stained glass window or something like that. People you could learn from, people whose lives were relevant to what we were doing, had something to teach us. And at the Catholic Worker, a little bit like here, the kind of canon of saints wasn't just confined to canonized saints like Benedict or Pope Francis, St. Francis or Teresa of Avila, but Dorothy Day would speak almost, you know, in the same breath about people like Camus, or writers that she admired like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, who were flawed people but great souls in their own way, who opened a window for us in a deep way so that we could see human reality, the reality of suffering, and the meaning of love and solidarity in a social, you know, context might mean. And she's talked about all those kind of people all the time. I didn't make my home in the Catholic Worker more than 5 years, but I took with me these kind of lessons and continued to think about it. And when I wrote my first book that Michael mentioned, All Saints, came out 20 years ago, it really was a kind of Catholic Worker book of saints. And it makes me happy that many of the people I wrote about, as you mentioned, are here on your walls too, that you don't have to be a Catholic to appreciate or acknowledge spiritual or moral or human greatness expressed, you know, sometimes at a price that people had to pay to live out their vocations in some deep way. And so I wrote this book, and it's a kind of book of daily reflections on people I called saints, prophets, and witnesses for our time. And yes, it includes St. Francis and St. Clair and St. Augustine, maybe people like that. But it also includes Anne Frank and Camus and Martin Buber and Gandhi is actually in my book. It's actually on the cover of my book with several other icons. And why I was so motivated to do that was not just because these are people that I admire or think that people should know about, but because my belief in the power of living witness. Dorothy Day was not a big idea, concept kind of person. The first time I met her, I said, I was trying to think of some clever question, you know, to make an impression on her. And I said, how do you reconcile Catholicism and anarchism? And she just said, well, it's never been a problem for me. The point was, for her, she was not interested in talking in this kind of theoretical level. She really was much more interested in talking about living witnesses, how ideas were embodied. What was the payoff in a human life of these ideas? That was the kind of test of their reality and their credibility, their authority. See how they're lived out. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, when we tell about, well, what did Dorothy Day stand for, you know, you can only really tell that by telling her story and how she lived it out, not she stood for personalism and anarchism and distributism and community and whatever. What does it look like when she lived it out? You can have all kinds of things. Well, I believe in the option for the poor, or I believe in nonviolence or whatever. What does that actually mean, how you live your life? And I knew from my own experience the power of a living witness to ignite something, to give you that kind of burning heart, that sense of consolation, that feeling that, that you're being drawn like a magnet, you know, toward some better potential or possibility in your life. And I was very interested as I wrote about saints to discover how this was a kind of motif in so many of their lives. How one kind of spark could be passed along over time. How, as I say, one lamp can light another. So many people's lives were changed, so many saints, by their encounter with another holy person. And that might be through a personal encounter, but it also might be by reading a book about their lives. I was struck by, you know, in the Confessions of St. Augustine, great doctor of the church, bishop, theologian, of one of the greats of his time. And he wrote, one of his great contributions was to write this book, The Confessions, where he looked at his own personal life as a story and a kind of a spiritual text where you could read and discern the presence of God or grace in a person's life, in one's own life. So we don't have to just read holy books. We can learn from those how to read our own lives. Pope Francis says that in his document on holiness also, that if we, that the greatest spiritual text is to look back on your past life. Look back on the times when things seemed darkest or most closed, most despairing, and see if there was not some spark of grace that was available there, some possibility that led us out of that or that led us on the path of charity or hope or faith. So that's kind of the invention of St. Augustine in his book, The Confessions. And if you've read it, you know, a lot of it is all about how he pursued a life of pleasure and he pursued all kinds of different philosophies and he became a great scholar. But something he was still searching for, and he finally began to through a great bishop, Ambrose, heard the gospel in a different way. He thought it was just kind of silly, simple stories that were very unsophisticated compared to Cicero or compared to great literature that he read. But when he began to read it, as he said, in a kind of spiritual sense, it began to have a compelling hold on him. And so he was tempted to become a Catholic. You're a Christian, you might say. And something kept holding him back. And he describes how in the midst of that, somebody gave him The Life of St. Anthony, which was a popular bestseller of the time by St. Athanasius, a biography, one of the first great lives of the saints, about this desert father, St. Anthony, who heard in church one day the gospel text, if you'll be perfect, sell all that you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. And so St. Anthony actually set about literally to do that. And he didn't just, his way of following, it led him out into the desert, away from a world where Christianity was becoming more accepted and officially recognized. He went out to the margins, went out to the desert, and lived there for years and years by himself, and he confronted, you know, physical dangers and threats from scorpions and alligators and hunger and sleeplessness. And he was tormented and visited by demons that appeared in all different kinds of forms. But when he emerged from the desert and eventually formed a kind of community, became an abbot, everybody was amazed by, you know, that he wasn't a crackpot. He seemed like he had this kind of glow to him. There was this joy that kind of emanated from his face. And St. Augustine's reading this, and he's thinking, like, this is, God, this is not a guy from, like, way back in Bible times. This is, like, just, you know, one generation ago. That God is doing things like that in our own time. Filled him with a wonder. He thought, if St. Anthony could do that, what's holding us back? Well, more things happen. He eventually, you know, is baptized, becomes a great Catholic, etc. But what I took from that was, that impact of an experience, of a story, of an idea that you see lived out in a person. Now, I don't know how many people are attracted by life among the scorpions and the alligators or that sort of thing, but the same motif, you know, happens in so many ways. You have Thomas Merton, you know, when he becomes Catholic, going through the Catholic Encyclopedia, and he sees pictures of Trappist monks, And he has exactly the same kind of experience of thinking, wow, people are actually living like that in my own time. You know, it's not just from the Middle Ages. And he finds it, you know, fantastically desirable. And he'd never actually met a Trappist, but he already thought this was heaven on earth, you know. And then people read, you know, Thomas Merton's book, and they don't necessarily become Trappists. But it awakens in them this idea that there is some counterpoint to the quest or the question that they feel in their own hearts, that's seeking some kind of deeper answer. You can see this not just, you know, okay, there's Augustine and Antony. Look closer to home in El Salvador. Archbishop Romero, who was about to be canonized as a saint, who was shot while saying Mass, as you know, in 1980, after 3 years in which he'd become a great voice of the voiceless and champion of justice for the oppressed and the crucified peoples of his country. And as a result, he's eliminated by the army and the death squads to still his voice. And people wonder, where did this guy come from? He's, you know, his only 3-year ministry as Archbishop of San Salvador. And when he was chosen to be Archbishop, he was the choice of the oligarchs. He was not the one that the kind of People's Church people, you know, kind of people in the Jesuit stuff wanted, because he was considered a kind of uptight sort of guy, very obsessed by rules and liturgy and doctrine and doing things the right way. And kind of aloof and pious and not somebody who was going to shake things up. But one of the things that happened very early, within just a month or so, when he became Archbishop, was that a priest he knew named Rutilio Grande, who was a Jesuit, who was known as somewhat of a radical, and had, people were saying he was kind of a communist, but Romero knew him from, he'd been a director in the seminary, and Romero knew him, and knew he was a good guy, and thought that maybe Grande was exaggerating. We talked so much about the evils of the oligarchs and that sort of thing, the military. And Rutilio Grande and a peasant and a young teenage boy are riddled with bullets as they're driving down the road. And Romero is so shaken by this. And he goes there to Aguilares, the village where Grande was, and sees his body with all the bullet holes in him, says Mass there. And it, you know, I won't say it was just that, but in some way it was an event that set him on his own road, you might say, his own road to Calvary 3 years later. As he took on, it's funny, one of the Jesuits said, when he preached after that, it's as if Grande's spirit or voice had passed over to the Archbishop. And they thought, where did this guy come from? You know? When I was growing up in the Episcopal Church, I went to a church, it was called St. Alban's Church. Nobody ever told me who St. Alban was. St. Alban, as I discovered later, was a 4th century Roman Briton, part of the Roman Empire in Britain, at a time of persecution of the church. A priest who was being chased by the soldiers or something knocked on his door and asked for shelter, and he took him in. And he listened to this priest all night tell him about the gospel. And that morning, as they heard the hounds or the troops coming, he exchanged his own cloak with the priest and sent him out the back door and was arrested in his place. And he was, you know, the judge was furious when he discovered that he'd been deceived in this way. And so he said, well, now you have to take the punishment, you know, that would have, you know, for the priest. And he said, gladly. And so he was beheaded, and it says, so therefore baptized in his own blood. But the executioner, the first executioner, that is, was so moved by his courage that he refused to carry out the execution. So he was also executed. So I go to this church, you know, St. Alban's Church, Nobody ever talks about who St. Alban is. You know, this is some English saint. You think they're all just bishops or something like that. But to think that your church is named after somebody who was the proto-martyr of Great Britain, the first martyr described in Bede's ecclesiastical history. Again, that kind of subversive influence or effect of one person who says no, or who says yes, you know, depending on which is the considered the more subversive or radical thing to say in the context. Skip ahead many centuries to another person who said no, and who was also beheaded, and has had a big influence on me. That's Franz Jägerstätter, who was recently beatified by the Catholic Church as a kind of penultimate step to becoming, being named a saint. How many people here have heard of Franz Jägerstätter? I don't know. You Catholic workers, keep your hands down. Franz Jägerstätter was an Austrian farmer, not a lot of education. He had become kind of a rowdy character in his youth, but then married a very serious Catholic woman. And he had several children. And he became more serious in his practice of the faith. He became a sexton in his church. He was very, very disturbed when Austria voted to be incorporated in Greater Germany, the so-called Anschluss. He said that it reminded him of the scene where the Gospels, where the crowd cries for Barabbas, you know, rather than Christ. He was the only person in his town who voted no on that. And it was noticed, but people thought, well, he's just sort of an eccentric guy. He doesn't do any harm. He's not out there preaching against the Nazis. But when the day came when he was called to serve in the army, which would involve taking an oath of allegiance to the Führer, he knew he was going to refuse that. So he didn't wait. He just went and reported himself at the police station, the next town, turned himself in, and never came out again. Before taking that stand, he had consulted his local pastor and even gone to the next town to visit the bishop. I mean, it's amazing to think. This is a peasant, and he decides he's going to go have an audience with the bishop and say, what should I do about this? My conscience tells me I should refuse this order. And not to single this priest or this bishop out, virtually anybody would have said the same thing to him. That's not your business, it's not your problem. Your job is to be a good father, good husband. What good is it going to do if you throw your life away? Not to mention, you know, defending your fatherland in an honorable way. You don't have to be implicated necessarily in crimes or a war. And they, basically it was not his responsibility. And he couldn't see it that way. He believed in a very traditional way in the idea that to die with a mortal sin means you would be separated from your children forever. Church taught that with regard to all kinds of things, like using birth control. But nobody was saying, applying that to the question, should you take an oath of allegiance to a satanic dictator? Which is how he saw it. He said he had a dream where there was a big shiny train. Everybody was getting on this train. All kinds of people, bishops and priests and respectable people were crowding, packing to get on the train. They're saying, all aboard, train's about to leave. And he asked, where's this train going? And the answer is, this train is going to hell. And he said that for him, it was an image of the whole country under the sway of the thrall of National Socialism that was on this path toward hell. And what should a Christian, a good Catholic, do if you see it in those kinds of terms? But to jump off, even if it costs you your life, rather than follow it to its natural destination. And that's what he was prepared to do. So he says, no, I won't take this oath. They try to persuade him all different kinds of ways. Maybe he could be a non-combatant. Maybe he could be a medic or something like that. His wife certainly would have liked it if he had found some way to save his life. It certainly left her and her family in the lurch. But no, he wouldn't do it, and he was beheaded, 1943. Now, he did this without any expectation that he was going to end the war, that he was going to topple Hitler with this kind of action. He had no expectation that anybody at all would even know what he had done, that it would be remembered by anyone, except maybe with a certain embarrassment or shame by his family or his neighbors, which is sort of what might have happened. Not his wife certainly held him in reverence, honored his conscience. I think she deserves to be canonized herself, quite an unusual partner. She trusted him to follow his conscience. And many, many years later, an American Catholic who had been a CO in World War II himself, named Gordon Zahn, was doing research in Germany and came across the story and wrote a book about him called In Solitary Witness, which is a wonderful title, In Solitary Witness. All alone. All alone in all of Austria. All alone practically in history, this guy. And he wrote this book, and as a result, the witness, the story of Franz Jaeger's daughter became known. Now, once you hear that someone has done that, it's like breaking the 4-minute mile or the first person to step on the moon or something. It opens your conscience and your imagination, your heart to possibilities that you never realized were even possible before. The story of Franz Jaegerstatter that was published in the 1960s had a lot of impact on many young Americans who at that time were struggling with their own question about whether to cooperate with the draft during the Vietnam War. I know one of them was a young man named Randy Keeler, a Harvard graduate, very handsome guy, very idealistic, very well-spoken and intelligent. And at a conference of the War Resisters International in 1969, he got up and he talked about the price that people were paying to stand up to this war with the only thing that they had, their freedom, their lives, their conscience. Casting their whole vote, as Thoreau put it. And he then, just very calmly, he listed some of the people who were in jail, and he said, and I'm very proud that soon I'll be joining them. Now, in the audience that day, there was somebody who didn't quite fit in with the rest. It's my father, Daniel Ellsberg. This is 1969. He was back from 2 years in Vietnam. He'd been working for many years as a defense analyst. He had come to abhor the war. He'd come to believe that the war was a crime. He had tried to oppose it as an insider, and he'd published op-ed pieces, and he'd spoken at conferences, and he'd done various things. But when he heard this talk of this young man, he rushed out of the room. He had to leave, and he just collapsed in the bathroom sobbing. And he said it raised the question for him, what could I do to help end this war if I were willing to go to prison? And that's a mighty big leap from writing op-ed pieces or something. For somebody who'd had the highest top secret, you know, above top secret security clearances, consummate insider, advisor to the Secretary of Defense, all these kind of things like that. What could I do if I were willing to go to prison? Well, it suddenly opened up all kinds of possibilities for him. And the immediate idea that came to his mind was, in his safe, back at the Rand Corporation, he had a 7,000-page top secret history of the Vietnam War, later became known as the Pentagon Papers, but that's not like what it was named. And he decided he would copy that and make it available to Congress as the basis for hearings. And I remember all this, it had direct influence on my life. He took me out for lunch one day. I was just in Los Angeles and at the Brentwood Country Mart in West End, Brentwood, and I actually took a picture and tweeted it out and said, this is the table where 49 years ago, my father asked if I would help him copy the Pentagon Papers. I was 13 years old. I didn't necessarily know what all of that meant, but he'd been giving me things he was reading by Thoreau, The Duty of Civil Disobedience, and speeches of Martin Luther King, books of sayings of Gandhi. And already that had kind of prepared the ground in me, even at a young age, for recognizing that, okay, that's it's like that kind of, what those people did. he described it as an act of civil disobedience, although we didn't really know what the legal implications were exactly. So I went with him just a couple of days. He didn't, you know, strictly speaking, need my help, kid, but although it is a slow and tedious process with Xerox machines of those days to copy that many papers. And then I didn't hear anything for a couple of years. Nothing seemed to happen. Turned out nobody in Congress would accept these papers. No one wanted to take that kind of risk. And so it was only after a couple of years that he turned then instead to the press, although that involved more risk for him. And if you've seen the movie The Post, I think a lot of you have, that brings back what that story was all about, although it's a little unfair to tell it as the Washington Post story. It was really the New York Times story, and the Washington Post came in on the tail end of it. I mean, a lot of people at the time was very upset about this. It's sort of like the New York Times, you know, how they broke Watergate or something like that. It would be, you know, the Washington Post would be upset. Anyway, I'm sure I could see Donald Trump mystified that anybody would make a movie about the failing Washington Post, fake news, enemies of humanity. I found it very inspiring when I saw it, even though they didn't include a cameo of me as a kid, because it showed that the kind of contagious quality of courage. My father took this step, entailed great risk. Unlike the publishers of the Washington Post, he actually was arrested and charged with something like 13 felony counts. He faced 115 years in prison. But still, what he had done, it empowered and inspired other people to do their job, to tell the truth, to confront risks and overcome them, to confront their fears and their doubts and overcome them, to take a step for the truth, for democracy, for combating the culture of lies and deception. Even I felt pride even to see the people running the linotype machines, and even the guys with their little paper caps, you know, throwing bundles of papers onto the newspaper. I was proud as an editor. My favorite scene was when they rush over after writing all night long on the Pentagon Papers story. They had to get it done by some deadline. They bring it in. And immediately you see this editor with a pen quickly editing the copy before it goes to press. Sometimes the survival of humanity, the survival of democracy, the survival of a republic or whatever can depend on ordinary people just doing their jobs without regard to the risk or the consequences. Now, you know, my father was a kind of singular act, I acknowledge, of courage, because he had so much to lose, supposedly, you know. But no more really than Randy Keeler or a lot of other people whose names I don't know, who did not have access to top secret documents, who did not have any conception that what they were doing by saying no would turn the world upside down or end the war. But they asked themselves, what must I do or what could I do if I was willing to go to jail? I was willing to risk my reputation or my freedom or my job or whatever. Some kind of risk, some kind of little sacrifice that means it's not the easy thing. It's going against the flow. One of Dorothy Day's favorite books was a novel called Bread and Wine by Ignacio Cialone, where there's a revolutionary who sneaks back into fascist Italy, disguised as a priest. And it's during a time of war. And he goes out at night with a piece of charcoal and writes no on the walls. And he says that one act of resistance like that can shatter the unanimity of consent. Have you ever heard of the Stanley Milgram experiments? You know, a lot of people know that famous psychological experiment where people thought that they were taking part in some kind of experiment on learning that involved asking questions to somebody in a different room, and if they got the wrong answer, they were supposed to give them a little electric shock. And they said, is this really okay? Is this okay to do this? And he said, oh, yeah, it's part of science. It's a scientific experiment. There's a guy in a lab coat, after all. It looks pretty, how you not trust somebody in a lab coat? Are you sure? And he said, no, it hurts a little bit, but it causes no lasting tissue damage. That was what they told them. Well, I don't know. So every time they would miss something, the shocks would get a little bit higher. Now, it turned out the person receiving the shocks was actually an actor. He was not really in shock at all, but he would start shouting, ooh, that hurt, oh, ouch. And they might even say, you know, I have a little heart condition. Is this safe? Yes, it's perfectly safe. Should I go on? Is this, should I really, okay? Yeah. No, you have to go on. Once the experiment has begun, you have to continue. Now, Milgram was criticized by a lot of people that because of the stress that he was causing to the subjects in this case, who thought they were hurting somebody. These were not sadistic people who were getting a kick out of it. These were people who felt a lot of doubt and anxiety about it, and they were very relieved to discover, phew, nobody got hurt, I feel so much better. But a lot of them also felt very bad about themselves, that they were willing to do that. Even they'd get up to the point where there was like a little red line that said, like, danger. And it was amazing how many people would just keep on going. Do I have to keep on going? Yes, I'm afraid once the experiment has begun, we have to continue. They did various variations on this experiment. And it was one of the things that was, the different variations included, if you could break down the level of the kind of sequence of events in the asking the question, delivering the shock, so that someone was more removed from actually applying the shock. In other words, they would say, okay, he got that wrong, and then someone else would push the button. Virtually everybody would go all the way. However, if it required two people to deliver the shock, and one of them said, hell no, I'm not going to do that, are you crazy? Everyone would stop. No one would continue. Once they had that example, the spell was broken, and they saw, you don't have to do this, you don't have to go along with this. My father hoped that people wouldn't just learn from the Pentagon Papers, but they might learn something from his example. Of course, that's one of the reasons why they wanted to throw the book at him. So it would be a negative example. People wouldn't imitate that. And in fact, not many have. But he's lived long enough now to see that there are people. There are certain kinds of people like that. He considers Edward Snowden sort of one of his godsons. And Snowden said that he was inspired in part by watching that movie about my father, the most dangerous man in America. That's exactly the kind of subversive influence that the government or the system does not want to have. I heard a story about a Trappist monk. He started a Trappist monastery in Brazil, in the jungle, Amazon somewhere. And after they've been there, this peasant comes trudging through the jungle and knocks on the door and said, I'd like to join you. And he said, where did you come from? How did you hear about this? He said, well, where I came from, I always heard that there were one or two kind of ways of what it meant to be a Christian. And then I heard about you, and I realized there was another way. I think that the power of living witness to open up possibilities for us, that there is another way, that there's another way of being, another way of being human, another way of being Christian, that there are possibilities in human existence or in relation to the challenges of our time that we had not considered before. That's what it means to hear a voice from the cross saying, Francis, repair my church. That voice can come in all different kinds of ways. It can come from a voice on a cross, evidently. It can come from a homeless person on the street. It can come from a demonstration against gun violence. It can come from Black Lives Matter. It can come in all different kinds of ways that awakens you and opens up something in our heart, makes our hearts burn with the idea that we're being called one step deeper, one step further into a different way, into different possibilities. When that happens, one lamp lights another. Thank you very much.
Sure. You tell me how much time you have. I have all the time in the world.
We typically have a few questions, entertain a few questions. And if you have a question for Mr. Ellsberg, please raise your hand.
I'm sorry, I forgot what happened to you. Yeah.
No, that was a happy ending. As it turned out, there's a wonderful documentary, I alluded to that, called The Most Dangerous Man in America, that tells his story. And what happened was that he went on trial, and they were throwing the book at him. But the Nixon administration wasn't satisfied with that. They wanted to destroy his reputation. And they engaged in all kinds of surveillance and secret skullduggery. They set up the plumbers, this secret unit in the White House, to go after my father. But also, it's funny, Nixon was kind of inspired. He said, we need a Daniel Ellsberg on our side, who would leak, you know, stories about what Trump would call the crooked Dems, you know, about his enemies. And so, the plumbers were really a leaking operation, as much as plugging leaks, but they engaged in all kinds of things that came out, including, you know, breaking into my father's psychiatrist's office, and even attempting to, you know, Nixon offered the judge in his case the directorship of the FBI. So fooling around with the FBI is not like just some new invention. All this came out just in the waning days of his trial, and this was all coming about because of the coincidence with Watergate. Now the impact of it was not only to have the case dropped against my father and he walked free, but you see, the connection with Watergate was that the same people who broke into the psychiatrist's office were the same people arrested at the Watergate Hotel. And although there was no direct connection between the White House and that break-in, there was all kinds of connection between them, the White House, and the break-in of the psychiatrist's office. So it was necessary for Nixon to pay them off, to be silent. And it was the hush money and the interference, you know, in the investigation, because they did not want it to go and to reveal what they call the White House horrors, that led ultimately to, you know, Nixon's resignation and the end of the war. So by a very strange kind of route, you know, my father's actions actually had way outsized kind of effect, not because directly because of the impact of the content of the Pentagon Papers, because people took that all in. It was a huge story. It couldn't have been a bigger story, 1971. And then in 1972, they reelected Nixon with the greatest landslide in history. But you never know. You plant these seeds, you do not know what kind of fruit they're going to have.
We have time for one more question. If you have a question, raise your hand. I'll bring the mic.
Quite moving. It's like a new history of the country, the way you put it. I was wondering, do you see any current examples of what someone might do now, say me or someone here, in the examples of courage that you've given? I mean, maybe you come across it. I mean, Snowden is one person, but we're not Snowdens. But there are examples, as you've given, of ordinary people. I was wondering if have occurred to you of recent possibilities.
Well, I just am very struck by, you know, how sometimes there's a kind of a dry tinder, a kind of a, you know, that is wildfire conditions, and it takes and in those conditions, one act of truth-telling or courage can start something outsize. And we've seen examples of that in our own country, you know, over and over again, I think, in the last year or so. I think of the hashtag MeToo movement that began, you know, with calling out Harvey Weinstein, and it turned out there were all these women who had stories like that to tell, and then it turned out, well, it's not just Harvey Weinstein problem, it's a much, much bigger pervasive cultural issue of gender oppression, sexual harassment, whatever, and that, you know, the women who look at the the gymnast, you know, young woman who steps forward and tells this, you know, very embarrassing story that's haunted her about how their coach and, you know, their trainer or doctor or whatever had abused her, gave the courage to others to then speak up. And, you know, he was on trial, and like 150 young women and girls got up and told this stories over and over again, giving power to people who had suppressed their voice and felt that they were silenced. And you see in the Black Lives movement, in the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement, with the, you know, the shooting of Trayvon Martin, that became, it was not like this never happened before. As we discover now, it has happened so commonly that you can't even, you know, keep track of how many cases there are. And yet it caused a movement and a response. We see it in the response of the people who stepped up when there was the Muslim ban at the airports, who rushed there to offer free legal counsel and to resist. We're seeing it now with the students that started in Florida, but it's sparked a much bigger thing. What it can take for a handful of people to say no, to say enough, to say we're not going to be part of this, and how that kind of breaks that spell. You know, how many school shootings have there been? And you see this same old script every time, not just schools, other places, Mother Emanuel Church or whatever. How many times will President Obama had to go and give this very moving speech, and getting more and more depressed as he went along, as he realized nothing was going to happen? A congresswoman could be shot, a school full of little, first graders could be shot. And every time the same response: our thoughts and our prayers are with you, et cetera, et cetera. But what are you going to do? Now it's not the time to talk about politics or to politicize. And then the NRA would kick in and sell even more guns. And this time, something is different. And once you see that you can change the conversation, just a certain number of people, and it could catch fire. Now, it doesn't have to be on big cosmic historical level. Whatever the front is, whatever the issue is, where people are being silenced, where they're being hurt, where they're being harmed, put down, and some people who break with that and say, no, we're not going to take it anymore. We don't know where that's going to go, whether that could change the whole country, become a tidal wave, but I don't think it's going to go away. I think that once that no has been heard and spoken, whether it's Rosa Parks refusing to get off her seat in a bus, that starts the Montgomery bus boycott, that kind of launches a new civil rights movement in the South. Sometimes it takes is that catalyst, that one example of a person or a group of people standing together. And once they do that, that can have enormous power beyond, if it's the right time, if it's the propitious moment. So, thank you.
So I want to thank again Mr. Ellsberg, and also recognize Michael Collins and Reverend Leach, who have made this experience possible today. We thank you. At this time and every Sunday, we offer space in our service to take up an offering to support the ministries of this congregation here in the Austin community. And if you would like to make a donation specifically to the Wheat Lecture, please put your offering in the envelope provided. May what you give bring you joy.
Thank you.
In light of our time, we're going to skip the closing hymn, and I just invite us to move to our closing words. We invite you to all stand. This is a new ritual here in our congregation. Draw near to your neighbor. If you're comfortable, hold hands or place your hand on one another's shoulders. As we share these words together. The hand you hold belongs to a person whose heart is sometimes tender, whose skin is sometimes thin, whose eyes sometimes fill with tears, and whose laughter is a beautiful sound. The hand you hold belongs to a person who is seeking wholeness and trusts that you are doing the same. As we leave this sanctuary, may our hearts remain open. May our voices stay strong. May our lives be living witnesses. And may we live each more day with love and compassion. May you go in joy and in peace. Blessed be.
You can treat this post-salute as a recessional, and choir rehearsal starts at 12:50.
Thank you.